Good morning, and welcome to the November 4th, 2024 edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, Park City and Heber.
It is chilly this morning. A good time for you to pour yourself another cup of coffee and sit and listen to us. We got some interesting stuff coming on this morning. We're going to start by talking to Cammie Kirkham-Herrett. She's the area manager over the new Barnes & Noble that's coming to Quimble Junction.
And then we'll chat with Chris Updike of U.S. Bank on what is happening with mortgages and interest rates. And we'll finish our hour by chatting with, speaking of coffee, Mark Robinson of Powder Hounds Coffee.
All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. Please stay tuned. Parkites are about to have a new place to shop for books. Barnes & Noble is coming to town and will be opening a new location in Kimball Junction. Here to tell us about it is the area manager for Barnes & Noble, Cammie Kirkham-Herrett. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Cammie, tell us a little bit. Let's start with some specifics about the new store. When does it open, and where is it located?
It is located in the Redstone Complex at Kimball Junction, and we are opening on November 20th at 10 a.m.
And just to help our listeners understand it, that's the old Bed Bath & Beyond site, isn't it?
Yes.
So that's a fairly sizable location. How many square feet is it approximately?
Almost 22,000 square feet. Very good size.
Wow. Yeah. Now, in terms of Barnes & Noble stores, do we have a Goldilocks range of big, little, and middle? And if so, where does this one fit?
This, I would say, is probably on the upper end of our stores. We do have a tendency to build our stores to fit the community and the spaces in which they're in. We have a range of stores as small as 4,000 square feet and as big as 35, 40,000 square feet. So this is on the upper end.
And just to give our listeners perspective, I know a lot of us have been to the Sugar House store.
Yes.
How big is that store?
Sugar House is about 24,000. So
it's pretty comparable.
Pretty comparable.
Pretty comparable.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Looking forward to the opening. It's opening 2 days before the mountain opens. just a side note.
So something to do for those 2 days. We can read doing skiing.
Exactly. Yeah. 2 days of reading and then hit the mountain. So I'm going to just jump. We hear the era of brick-and-mortar bookstores is over. Why does opening this store make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, and certainly that has been a conversation that has been had many times throughout the years. We've seen a real resurgence in bookstores and in readership post-pandemic. Certainly people fell in love with reading again. We saw Book Talk give a real resurgence to reading, especially among younger readers. And bookstores have always kind of, you know, been around to stay. There's really nothing that can replace walking through a bookstore, browsing mm-hmm. the shelves, and finding what's your next best read. Barnes & Noble in particular has had a really large resurgence in our store openings. We have opened 43 stores this year with plans to open 15 more before the end of the year. And the communities and readers that we're serving are very excited to have us in their towns.
It sounds like you have to do some pretty careful analysis to figure out where it makes sense. I mean, you're talking about opening stores. My guess is that if I go back 5 years, there probably a number of stores were closed, right? But now you're opening them up. Now you're opening them up in different places. Talk to us about the demographics. What do you look for in trying to figure out where to open a store?
Yeah, I mean, there's a fair number of things that we look at. We certainly look at, if the community is well served by the, you know, bookstores that they can get to. Here in, of course, Park City, we have the wonderful Dolly's and Atticus Books, which are absolutely amazing. But if you need a little bit broader selection, you're headed all the way to Salt Lake City.
You're headed to Sugar House.
Yeah, you're headed to Sugar House. So we're really happy to be up here. We've looked for a long time for the exact right space, and we think we found it at the Redstone Complex.
And I guess one of the things you talked about a minute ago was why are bookstores needed? Why are they back, if you will? Let's talk a little bit about the experience. What is it about the experience that you think draws people to want to go walk through a bookstore? I know I enjoy it, but talk a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, of course. Bookstores are really, at their heart, community spaces. They're places where people can either be alone with their community of books or be with friends and family while they explore books. you know, the concept of being surrounded by these hundreds of thousands of authors' life works is really just a very meaningful experience. A lot of people talk about the smell of a bookstore when you walk in. It's a tactile experience.
That and coffee.
Yeah, and the coffee. And, of course, the coffee. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's just nothing that replaces that ability to pick up a book and look at it, read the back, maybe get a recommendation from a reader. You just can't replace that with any sort of online experience.
And let's talk about recommendations. The ability to get quality recommendations is, I know, something people value in a bookstore. How do you find staff that reads? And what are you looking for in that staff?
Yeah, we really seek out a diverse staff that reads a diverse amount of books. And most of our interview process is focused on what are you reading and what do you love to read? And talk to me about your favorite book or a book that you've read recently. We seek out readers from all different genres, nonfiction, fiction, young adult, children's, so that we have a really well-balanced and diverse staff that's ready to recommend across the store.
I have to believe that a company as sophisticated as Barnes & Noble has a pretty clear vision of how many, you know, books per square foot, right? Titles per square foot, sales turnover. Talk to us a little bit. Can we sneak behind the curtain a little bit and talk about how you do that kind of analysis?
Yeah, we do pretty in-depth analysis when we're building each of our stores because we want each store to be different and localized to the community. As the area manager, I do a fair amount of research before we take possession of the store, to make sure that we're focusing on areas that the customers in this community will love. So, for example, I will say I want a really deep backlist catalog of, you know, nature, hiking, outdoor sports in Park City. But I also want a lot of literary fiction. I want a lot of serious nonfiction. You know, I dig into the community a little bit to figure out what the assortment should be when we open. And then from there, we watch what we sell and we grow those categories based on what our customers are actually buying.
So if I were to look at a bookstore, if I were to have the master list of what's being stocked in Sugar House or Park City, and then I were to go to Phoenix, okay, would there be a lot of differences? I mean, is there a lot of autonomy at the sort of area manager level in terms of content in a Barnes & Noble store?
Yeah, a huge amount of autonomy. In fact, that is one of our number one jobs. We have several people that sort of give us a baseline inventory to start. But again, that is highly tailored by the feedback that I give them about what I want to see in the store. We recently opened a store in Santa Fe, for example, and Santa Fe is a really big art community, and so we have a very, very large art selection in that store. And then, again, as we see what the readers are really buying, we actually have a person here locally in Salt Lake who individually purchases each book for each store. And as the books sell, they make a choice about whether or not to bring in more, whether or not to replenish at the same rate, and to watch what is selling in certain categories.
So I have a vision of this person sitting in a computer with giant screens, like, ooh, this book sold. What do I make from that? I mean, that's almost literally what you're saying.
That
person is running analytics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing, all right, how many copies did I sell of the new Michael Connelly book?
Yeah.
What does this mean? Do I need to, you know, and that's really what's going on. That's how you do this, isn't
Absolutely,
it?
Yeah.
And what a fun job.
Yeah, right?
And how long did it sit on the shelf?
Exactly. And how long did it sit on the shelf? For sure. And you know, that changes based on the category as well. And, you know, it's important to us that that be a person, not an algorithm. So, you know, she works out of the Sugar House store. She knows the community very well, and she's able to, you know, take that information and really use it in a meaningful way.
Now, jumping back to, so you take care of the area.
Mm-hmm.
How many stores is the area?
This area is 18 stores.
So you're in, you,
from where to where?
This is Utah, Idaho, and Montana.
Holy cow.
People read in Montana?
Oh, yeah. Lots of people read in Montana, yeah.
So let's talk about, when we look at this store, approximately how many, let's start with books, because we're going to talk about what other stuff you've got in there besides coffee. About how many titles will be in this store?
Around 100,000 titles of books.
So there'll be 20 books for every occupant of Park City.
You're welcome.
100,000 titles. Yeah. And just going back to my turnover story, Of those 100,000 titles, how many will turn over within a year?
Oh, all of them will turn over within a year. Yeah, easily.
Wow.
Yeah, some faster than others. Some will be replenished at a faster clip than others. But yeah.
Well, so what else are you going to besides books? We know Barnes and Noble has other
stuff.
Merchandise.
Yeah, we do.
what else will you have in the store?
So we have a really impressive, I've been very impressed with our newsstand selection. We have over 3,000 titles in our newsstand category, which is going to be very exciting. We have a wonderful gift and paper selection, which is journals, pens, gift wrap, and, you know, those kinds of things. And we will have toys and games, which are fabulous. Lots of puzzles, board games, lots of Lego. And we'll have a very impressive vinyl collection as well.
Vinyl records.
Vinyl records.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Now, as far as the newsstand, so you'll have the Washington Post, you'll have the New York Times, you'll have the Phoenix Sun?
No,
that's a basketball team.
So will you have any newspapers?
I'm not sure what our newspaper situation will be. I have to check on that. That varies by location, but magazines, periodicals.
People say magazines are dead, but you're going to have this huge variety of magazines on.
Yeah.
Again, talking about Sugar House, there's one of the things that's fascinating, we covered a lot in this show, is that America's this country full of subcultures. Mm-hmm. And one way of looking at subcultures is the magazines. I mean, mm-hmm. There are magazines of truly obscure sort of areas that have their own fans. And that's one of the things that you will be able to do, is be able to find that variety, I take it, at your newsstand.
Absolutely, yeah. I was putting them away myself the other day, and I'm always just fascinated by the types of magazines that we have, and by, as you say, the subculture. We have, you know, everything from model railroading to yachting to...
I bet you even have beekeeping.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He's a beekeeper.
Yeah. Beekeeping is real. Yeah.
So I want to talk about vinyl, because I have recently rediscovered vinyl, and Kevin and I have been talking about vinyl. How many vinyl titles will you cover, and is that stuff really moving again?
Vinyl has had a huge surge in popularity. The younger generation is very interested in sort of that tactile experience. In fact, we're even seeing a bit of a resurgence in CDs. I don't know the number of titles mm-hmm. that we'll have, but it's quite large. I was pretty happy with the selection that I saw when I was there.
Hmm. Will you have a coffee shop inside?
Yes.
Oh,
yes, we will have our Barnes & Noble Cafe.
At 18 degrees this morning, I'm thinking a lot about coffee.
Fair.
Now, will you be having book signings and other programming at the store?
Yes. Yeah, we have a robust lineup scheduled for our first month of open. We're sort of currently finalizing some of those dates and with some of our authors. But Utah has a very healthy local author population, and those authors always come out to support the bookstores. So if you follow us on, you know, Instagram or X BN Park City UT, that's where you can find all of our events, as well as of course, on our website, bn.com.
XBN, say it again.
It's BN Park City UT.
That's our
handle.
That's your handle.
Yeah.
And again, when I look at the programming in the Sugar House store, which I looked at over the weekend, I mean, you are having authors on a fairly regular basis.
Oh, yeah.
And has Salt Lake City become a stop for authors doing these big national tours as well?
Absolutely. Salt Lake City and really the whole Wasatch Front is an incredibly literary town. We're highly literate. We're voracious readers. We produce, as I said, some amazing authors out of Salt Lake City, you know, well-renowned New York Times bestselling authors, Jack Carr. You've got Brandon Sanderson, Brandon Mull. I could go on and on. Trisha Levenseller, all from Salt Lake City. And
Jack Carr's a Park City local.
Yes,
we have to claim.
Yes, he is. Yes, Michael Finkel as well, one of my favorites. Many, many authors make Salt Lake City, and occasionally Park City a stop on their national tours because of that.
Now, what about kids? Kids authors, any programming for kids?
Yeah, we'll definitely do some kids authors. We have great kids authors in the area as well. We're planning to do weekly story times.
I was going to ask you about that.
Oh, good.
Yeah. We will have Pete the Cat joining us for our grand opening. So that's very exciting.
Who's Pete the Cat?
Who's Pete the Cat?
Yeah.
Pete the Cat's amazing.
Okay.
he's a kids book character.
Okay.
So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. And he's very cool. He drinks a lot of coffee.
That's all we need is a cat on coffee.
Yeah. And we do like Lego build events, lots of stuff for kids.
Cool. Now a switch to business operations. How many employees are you going to have in the store? And how is the process going? I mean, everybody in this town has a hard time finding employees and good employees.
Yeah. I mean, we've been hiring for months, and we're pretty much hired up. We have about 25 employees right now. That might come up a little bit for the holiday season. But yeah, we're doing quite well finding people who love to read and who want to be around books for their job.
And what kind of hours are you going to have?
We'll be open 10 to 8 Monday through Thursday, 10 to 9 Friday, Saturday, and I believe 11 to 6 on Sunday.
Now, I know but I could imagine if you go to a bookstore in the evening, is besides the coffee bar, will there be a beer and wine bar?
not at this location. No.
I mean, Whole Foods sells beer and wine.
I know. Which is phenomenal. I know. Yeah. That is not something we're dipping our toe into quite yet.
Has that happened at other Barnes & Noble locations around the country?
Yeah. We've had a few that we've tried that out at. We still have Barnes & Noble. Yeah, exactly. We still have a few Barnes & Noble restaurants that serve beer and wine. I think there's 2 or 3 of those across the country. But mostly we found that coffee is our jam.
I'm sorry to go back, but I'm still trying to wrap my head around how somebody figures out how to buy 100,000 books. Okay, we on the station, we on this program, we are monitoring new books to try to find new authors of financial and business-related books, and there's stuff every week that we can read reviews in the various newspapers. How do your buyers keep track of what's new and know what they ought to buy?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really complex question, obviously. As you know, there's so much new publishing, new wonderful publishing every day, every week, every month, every year. And then, of course, the backlist, the books that stay in print that are perennials are, you know, ever growing. We have a very skilled, qualified team that sort of focuses on categories at our home office, and they allocate sort of a handful of what feels right based on store demographics and previous sales. The store will then see those books come in and decide, do we need more of this? Is this something we'd like to feature? Is this a really great book for our community? And that's when that local person comes in and they'll order in more based on what they feel like the book's potential has within the store.
You know, we see books when they pop up in reviews. But my guess is that just as with other retail, there's a long process that's gone on before that. So, and you know, given the importance of Barnes & Noble, my guess is that publishers are reaching out to you guys all the time. Talk about that process we don't see. What happened in the before times? Are people marketing a book 6 months before it actually hits the stands? How does that work?
Yeah, oftentimes more than 6 months before it hits the stands. When there's a book that is, you know, an incredibly good book that's important to a publisher, they'll start talking with bookstores, with Barnes & Noble and bookstores across the country, you know, up to a year before its actual publication. So there is a long process. I always say nothing happens fast in publishing because there's a lot of moving parts.
And will you have self-published books?
Yeah. I know
that's kind of big in Park City.
Yeah, we'll absolutely have. We have a great program for self-published books, both nationally and locally, depending on how the publication happens.
Gotcha. So I want to touch on Barnes & Noble membership and give you a chance to explain why it is I should pay, what is it, $25? Is it $25? Whatever the number is.
Yeah. We have 2 membership programs, actually. One of them is free, and that is a pretty straightforward thing. For every $10 you spend, you get a stamp. For every 10 stamps, you get a $5 reward. So you come in, you give us your barcode from your Barnes & Noble app and collect your points, your stamps, I should say. We have a paid membership that is $39.99 a year. That gets you the stamps, as we discussed before, and then a variety of other things, 10% off all of your purchases. A free size upgrade in our cafe for every beverage you purchase. You pay a size smaller than that. A wonderful tote bag every year, and a host of other benefits as well. So
yeah, we did the math and found that the discount paid for itself.
It really does.
Many books
yeah,
as we bought.
It does.
And so what is the company's approach to pricing? Do you price things as it's written on the back cover?
Yeah, we go with the publisher set the pricing, and we stay with that. We discount based, again, on the local community. The discounting is entirely up to the store, how they'll discount, other than our Barnes & Noble bestsellers, which are sort of our out-of-box, you know, 30% off bestsellers. But then the store will decide what they want to feature, what they're really wanting to recommend and sell, what they might want to give a little incentive on to readers.
But that 30%, the Barnes & Noble bestsellers, that's a fairly sizable list, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty decent.
So basically, when we're looking at new publications, the new Michael Connelly book, the new sort of hit, if you will, book, those are likely to be discounted off that publisher's list.
Yes. Absolutely.
Really? New books?
Yeah.
I didn't expect that.
Yeah.
Now, I want to visualize this store. I love 22,000 square feet. I love walking through a bookstore. Do I get to walk through all the aisles to get to the coffee bar?
Yeah, you do.
It's kind of like the casino, right?
Yeah. I was actually just saying yesterday that I feel like this store is just so beautifully designed and laid out. There's lots of nooks and crannies and rooms in which to sort of tuck yourself away and browse your favorite category. Lots of spaces for seating, but it just feels very cozy to me. Even at 22,000 square feet, I just feel like it's so cozy, and there's so many wonderful places to sort of tuck away.
Yeah, I walked in about a month ago while they were still working on it, and
yeah.
I was astonished by the size.
Yeah.
It, you know, without all the Bed Bath & Beyond stuff in there, And I was telling everyone about it. It's like, this is going to have a lot of books and a lot of space, and I imagine sofas to sit in a little corner. And
yes.
Yeah.
Okay, Cammie, before we go, where can listeners learn more? What are the website addresses?
Oh, yes, bn.com. You can look up Park City Store by zip code and follow the events there. BN Park City UT is our handle for Instagram and X, and you can find us on Facebook as well.
Okay. Wonderful. But before we go, is there a newsletter? So can someone register and get a weekly email on what's coming up that week from Barnes & Noble?
Absolutely. That's available on bn.com on our website.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. We've been talking to Cammie Kirkham-Herrett, the area manager that covers the new Barnes & Noble, which will be opening on November
20th.
All right. Thanks for spending time with us. We'll be right back after this.
For those of us lucky enough to afford a home but lacking the resources to buy it with cash, we need to get a mortgage. But when we do that, we're at the mercy of interest rates. The interest rates that bank charges are related to the Fed funds rate, which for the past few years, up until September of this year, have been rising. Joining us to share some information and speculation is U.S. Bank Mortgage Loan Officer Chris Updike. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
How are you?
I'm great. How about yourself?
Fantastic. Thank you. So now, how long have you been in the mortgage world?
I started in the mid-1999 period. So.
And what were average 30-year mortgage rates at that time?
Mid-sevens.
Mid-sevens.
Yes.
So what's it at now?
Mid-sixes approximately.
Okay, so it's a discount now.
Yeah.
So when people complain about interest rates, it's not really that bad comparatively.
Correct.
To, what is that, 25 years? Wow, 25 years in mortgages,
25 years.
And Chris, during that period, what's been the most challenging time when high interest rates were low? Talk to us about, when has it been hardest?
You know, obviously in 2009, it was difficult after the Great Recession. This has been a challenging time, too, because a lot of people have been spoiled for 15 years, essentially, since 2008.
Yeah.
The federal funds rate came down in 2010 to basically where it was during the pandemic. And people expect lower rates than what they've actually been at.
Yeah. So you've seen so many ranges. And so mid-sevens, about the highest. What was the lowest a few years ago?
Probably the mid-twos.
Mid-twos.
And actually in the 2000s, or 2000, they were in the mid to upper eights.
Whoa. So life is a series of actions and reactions, and we start talking about 2009. So one of the reasons for the big recession of 2008 was that there was a lot of paper being written for people who probably didn't really have the resources to support that paper.
Correct. So,
and my guess is that in 2009, the pendulum swung radically the other direction, and that you were demanding a lot more sort of support for new mortgages. Have I basically got that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's happened since then on that front?
The quality of paper in terms of qualifying for a mortgage changed significantly, where you didn't have to necessarily qualify. You had the ability to get debt mm-hmm. based off of your credit rating, regardless of what your ability to repay was. In today's environment, it's always been ability to repay. So it has changed the dynamics a bit, but in general, most people could repay the debt. But that did change in the mid-2000s because it was all speculation off of increased home values.
Are we seeing that again?
Not at this point in time, because the difference between there and today is there was a huge onslaught of inventory in 2007, 8, mm-hmm. 9, where we don't have the inventory at this point in time.
And that's an interesting point. When you talk about inventory, you're talking about homes for sale.
Correct.
The incredible increase in mortgage rates, you know, from where they were to where they are now, are we going to see people who are almost trapped, for lack of a better term, in their homes because they're sitting on a 2.5% rate, and for them to get the equivalent home now would cost substantially more on a monthly basis, so it makes no sense for them to sell?
I think there is a pickle going on at this point in time.
Pickle's a good word.
Because people don't want to leave because their debt service is so inexpensive. Mm-hmm. But they're either outgrowing their home or they're not outgrowing their home and they need to downsize.
Right.
But if they do either one, their payment or the cost of borrowing money and the cost of housing, which is a double-edged sword on this, increases their monthly obligation significantly.
So could they maybe rent their house and keep that nice low mortgage rate?
There are ways to do that, yes.
Is that what people are doing? Are you seeing that phenomenon?
Not so much at this point in time, but it does happen occasionally.
I'm going to ask you a broad philosophical question, which is where we are now at the relationship between income levels and housing prices is very problematic. Okay, you know, young families, you know, it's almost impossible for them to buy homes. Is there any sort of concept of changing the model, maybe going to a 40-year repayment cycle or anything else that would sort of help that problem mechanically?
Possibly. In the mid-2000s, there were 40-year mm-hmm. amortization products mm-hmm. with the same situation happening. Increased housing prices, people didn't think that it was keeping up with income, and we're in the same boat currently. It's just a different functionality at this point in time. There are some institutions that do 40-year amortizations. We do not, and it's not a common product.
Right, it's
today.
Not a common. I was curious. I'm trying to figure out how do we get out of this, right? And one way you build more housing. That's obviously one answer, but that's going to take a while. And I'm looking at the sort of midterm. Are there any other?
Well, in the early 2010s, basically housing production stopped, and our population still increased over time, and it's virtually impossible right now to build enough product for the demand.
To catch up.
And eventually, there'll be something that happens in the economy that will create more supply from existing homes. It's just a matter of what will that be?
What could that be?
Yeah.
Unemployment?
Are you going to downturn?
Recession?
A downturn.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So let's
so
think
people
about
can't afford where they are currently.
So in a downturn, what we're thinking is, okay, there's a downturn. There's not going to be fewer people. I'm struggling with how this is going to work.
Right, but a lot of people may not be able to afford to live where they live.
So there'll be more supply, but those people are going to have to go someplace else.
Correct.
So that sounds like a pretty unpleasant.
I mean, we saw a lot of migration during the pandemic.
Sure, fair enough. Mm-hmm.
There might be different types of migration that happens.
Yes, you could have people going. And again, with these increased mobility of employment, That's actually an interesting concept, is that you could have some reallocation.
Now we're going to jump into the Federal Reserve. So the Fed fund rate was between 0.05% and 0.10% from April 2020 through February 2022. Would you say that was the golden age of mortgage rates?
It's the lowest I've seen in my lifetime.
So now, obviously, banks have to make money off. So they borrow from other banks at the Fed fund rate, and then they loan it to people with a mortgage for a little bit more so they can service the loan and pay their employees.
In theory, yes. It works in that similar extent. But the federal funds rate is the cost of borrowing money overnight, to meet depository obligations.
Gotcha.
And it's short-term money. People, I mean, on a daily basis, it impacts all of us with credit cards, auto loans. Those are directly impacted by the federal funds rate. Mortgage rates are long-term rates that follow a different background, but in theory follow the same movement.
Gotcha. So that's why when the Fed dropped the rates in September, after the September meeting, mortgages actually went up just a little bit, I think I saw.
By more than 0.5%.
Yeah.
So they the federal funds rate went down 0.5% and mortgage rates went up 0.5%.
Okay. So we can't rely on that for mortgage rates.
No. But they was put into mortgage rates prior to the Federal Reserve's action. So it was baked into the market.
It was anticipation. Yeah.
But what happened post-reduction, there were more positive economic signs that made it more concerning that the Fed will continue that rate of cut.
Gotcha.
And what are they going to do this week?
It was forecasted about 0.5%, and that left the market about a month ago. Mm-hmm. And the forecast on Thursday is 0.25%.
That's what you're guessing.
That's what's expected.
And that's probably
expected.
What's priced in all likelihood to the. So if they do a quarter, probably we won't see a movement on long-term rates because it's already been priced in.
Yes.
Of course, we've got an election that's coming too, which may also affect things.
Well, I went back and looked just out of curiosity, and it really has not impacted mortgage rates that significantly.
Elections.
Correct.
Gotcha. So, and this little 0.25% change won't really yet. I'm sure there are people out there who are holding off on getting a mortgage going, just wait till the November meeting or wait for the December meeting, and then they're missing out on the house that they want because you can't refinance your purchase price. You can refinance your mortgage.
Correct. So if the right product is there for you to purchase, it's the right product.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
And you have to assume that that's what you need for yourself and your family, as opposed to wait for rates to drop because that product may never come back on the market.
Interesting.
Now, in terms of the local market, I mean, we see when we look at the real estate reports that come out periodically that prices are continuing to rise, sales are actually, I think, ticking back up again. What percentage of the local sales now are cash buyers as opposed to people who are financing?
I think it varies depending on what price point you're in. Mm-hmm. I would say 4 million and over might be more significantly cash. Mm-hmm. Anywhere, some months it might be as much as 100%, other months it might be 30%.
So someone can buy a $4 million house with 30%, $1.2 million, and did I get that math right?
Close enough.
And then mortgage the rest with.
Well, a lot of times people, even if they pay cash for a property, they will end up putting debt on it post-closing.
Post-closing.
In a different format in terms of a refinance versus an acquisition purchase.
Is that more expensive?
Yes.
Okay. So why do they do that? Cash flow?
To get the product off the market.
Okay. To buy. In other words, I got to buy it now. Okay, that makes sense.
Oh, and so maybe you get the it
price,
right away.
Yeah, maybe the price is more appetizing for the buyer, and the seller's willing to come down in price just because of the timeline of closing.
They can close quicker with cash.
How long does it take for a qualified buyer? And what's the price here in Park City? $2 to $4 million range. How long does it take a qualified buyer to get a loan?
Anywhere between 15 to 30 days.
We could do it that fast now, right?
Yeah, it's always
because
been
you've been doing it for 25 years. I've seen Chris. He goes through all your paperwork like a magician.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Now, on average in this area, I know myself, I would put 20% down and mortgage the rest. Is that kind of the average around here?
It's usually 25 to 30% down.
Gotcha.
And it depends also on the price point.
Right.
The higher the price point, you'll see more 40% down. Lower the price point, closer to 20.
Now, how often do you see someone who is effectively doing a cash buy, but nonetheless finances whatever the maximum is to have it be deducted? What's the maximum deductible at this point?
I believe it's $750,000.
How often do you see people taking $750,000 mortgages?
Not that often.
No, it's interesting.
Either they're way above it,
right,
or they're below it.
Okay.
Yeah. Jeez. All right, now I'm going to get speculative.
Oh, please.
We're gonna play here. So, let's see. Will the Fed meeting this week, dropping 0.25%, will that help the real estate business directly? By appearance.
I think this psychological component will be helpful for buyers and sellers.
Psychological component.
Right.
You gotta get psyched up to buy a house.
Well, the theory it's in everyone's mind that rates are coming down.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Oh, maybe I need to start looking again. Where the reality is mortgage rates might stay the same. Yeah. They might go up, they might go down, but I'm not saying that rates are in the sevens anymore, where people go, oh, they're in the sixes. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that.
Right. So if I bought a house now, mm-hmm, and I got 6.5%. How quickly could I refinance? Let's say the economy, the Fed drops rates over the next year, maybe a whole point. What? How quickly can I refinance after I get a mortgage?
The next day?
The next day.
It has to be cost prohibitive.
Right.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And that's why they have closing costs and everything, because it takes you a lot of work to place a mortgage, I'm sure.
Right. Well, it's just, I mean, it's a math game. The costs are this, and you save this much. What's your break-even point?
You know, as I zoom out, the idea 2% mortgages at some level in terms of the real cost of loaning money strikes me as unrealistically low, right? And
yes.
And there's some, you know the way they say that full employment is 4%. Is there, in your mind, for lack of a better term, normal sort of interest rate that you would expect to see a regression toward over time?
Earlier in the year, the forecast was that mortgage rates would be around 5% mid next year, approximately, right, towards the end of next year. That has been revised to 5.5%.
Okay.
Based off of current economic conditions. Mm-hmm. That will change again, but in general, the average interest rate since 1971, when Freddie Mac has kept that data, is still in the sevens.
Really? I would have thought it was closer to five. That's really interesting.
We've just been spoiled for 15 years.
Yeah, I looked in the 1980s, the maximum mortgage rate was 18.63%. Mm-hmm. I remember Starsky and Hutch back in the 70s, the TV show, and Huggy Bear, the loan shark. And they used to try to bust him because he was charging over 15%, and now banks are doing it, they were doing it in the 80s. Kind of crazy. So real quick, in your opinion, do you think we'll see a return of the economic crisis caused by, as we mentioned earlier, bad paper, the 2007 to 2010? Could that happen again?
Anything's always possible. But
right,
in general, based off of what created that with oversupply and basically paper that was fog and mirror, probably not in the short term. But who knows? That could change.
Exactly. Well, we've just spent a few minutes with Chris Updike from U.S. Bank, the mortgage originator, loan originator. Chris, anything else you want to add to share with our listeners? That's usbank.com.
Chris Updike, and thank you for your time, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Chris.
We'll be right back. Okay, we have Mark Robinson from Powder Hounds Coffee. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Good morning. Fantastic. Thanks to be here.
Yeah. Hey, so Powder Hounds Coffee, is that a new business?
It is. It was, in theory, designed about 10 years ago, but it was actually implemented last January.
Last January.
Correct. Designed about 10 years ago. What do you mean by that?
Well, there was a fantastic coffee company where I grew up, which is in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and it was a small little roastery, and I got a chance to kind of see the exploration of him starting a business and having a lot of success. And it was always a thirst and something that I always wanted to do, but I just didn't really know where to begin putting that first foot down. So
you've been thinking about this for 10 years.
I have, yes. I've traveled quite a bit and experienced so many different coffee settings that just I had an unbelievable experience that was, you know, not out of body, but certainly one to be remembered. And I always felt that that was a part of my collage of my journey of my career.
So. Yeah, so basically this business idea has been brewing for...
He's had a thirst for it, and it's been brewing.
Wow, this is very funny. Yes, exactly.
My daughter's going to kill me on that dad joke. Oh, sheesh. All right, so it's you and your wife.
Correct. Well, it's me. She right now has the reins of our family. She's had a lot of success in the medical device career, and that's my formal background as well. And once we decided that children were in our future, she said, Mark, it's time for you to go follow this, and you can also take care of the children and make this work. And so when we moved to Park City about 5 years ago, she supported it. And yeah, she was going to be, you know, the banker, and I was going to be the brewer. So.
The brewer and the banker sounds
That's
like a
right.
new movie coming out.
So over those 10 years, you mentioned having a significant experience.
Correct.
What was that?
I was working for a medical device company, and I got a chance to internationally travel to some fantastic places and train hospitals on how to use specific devices. And so, you know, I lived in Sydney, Australia for a couple of years, and just watching how they... you know, their processes of how they deliver coffee every morning, and it was unbelievable. It could have been at a gas station, but it was a great cup of coffee. It could have been at a restaurant. It was a great cup of coffee. And so just experiencing all those things, I was like, when I come back to the United States, that is going to be definitely on my front and center.
So let's talk about, people often, in terms of process, people often talk about the weakest link. Talk to us about the links in going from a bean in the ground to the cup. What are the key elements of producing a great bean and then producing a great cup of coffee?
Well, number one, you have to have a great bean, right? So if you were going to say the best bean in the world is probably Arabica, which would be my favorite bean, but there are other beans, but you need soil content, you need elevation. And because coffee is so subjective, like wine, you might like a Pinot or you might like a bold Cabernet. And so that subjectiveness also applies into coffee. Some people love the fruity coffees. I personally love earthy coffees, and earthy coffees typically are going to be a little bit more mountainy, a little bit north or south of the equator. But a lot of people love those Costa Ricans, those Peruvians. And so they each kind of have a different element of how they play into the water and then the process of how the bean is actually cultivated from the ground.
So do you visit plantations to pick your beans, or do you have suppliers in different areas?
Great question. Yeah, I have both. I mean, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, you're trying to source the best bean for the best, you know, economical model that's going to work for what your type of coffee you want to roast. I want to explore, I guess, the higher end coffees. And so that means AA rated beans. That means Arabica places from Tanzania, which I have not visited, but I am excited to. But I was fortunate enough to go down to some of the areas in Indonesia and see what the famous Sumatra was all about, or the Balinese beans. And so getting a chance to see how those processes they've been doing it the same way for the last 500 years, where if you go to Colombia, you know, everything is done with a process and it's built for that. And so every country has a different way, and some of them have a lot of money to do what they want to do in terms of their process of how they produce the bean. And then in Indonesia, some of the Sumatra beans, they'll actually just let the fruit sit on the ground for 30 days, and so that's called the wet hulling process. And that's where, you know, that's why the Sumatra taste has such an earthy taste to it, is because it's just been kind of rotting on the ground, where some places use high pressure water to get that fruit skeleton off of the bean. So they all kind of play a different part of the taste profile. And living in Park City, this is a very athletic, high motivated society. And so I always thought that there was a good, you know, need for a great bean that was also extremely healthy. We try to source organic beans, which is a big part of the coffee experience here as well. So
now, when you went to Indonesia, did you pick a bean or cherry, whatever you want to call it? Can you eat it right away and get an idea of what that's going to be once it's roasted and brewed?
You know, maybe an advanced palate you certainly could, but I specifically couldn't. I could see from where the green bean is to turning to the black bean. So that is, You know, what does the bean look like? Does it look like it's been degraded by like light, sun, air? So the key to it, I mean, coffee, a lot of people don't know this, but a green bean will stay very healthy for about a year if you don't expose it to light and heat. So you keep it in a cool, dry environment and it'll actually store extremely well. But once it's cooked, that's when the degradation starts to happen and the bean starts to age itself. So air, and that's why I only sell whole beans. You know, when you ground a bean, it loses a little bit of its life. You know, coffee bean is like lettuce. It does go bad. It expires.
So let's talk about what you sell and what the beans are, where you're getting them from. You mentioned you've been to Indonesia. Where are you sourcing your beans from now, and what are the different coffees that you're making?
Well, if you're in the coffee business, you certainly try to explore the lighter roasts, just because, you know, if you buy a nice filet, typically you don't want to overcook it. So most of my beans are either light to medium, medium to dark. I do have some of the more advanced espresso type beans, but the ones that I'm really passionate about are the light to medium beans. And the reason for that is you get to bring out different taste profiles and find a customer that really finds your coffee and likes that experience. So a lot of people love the fruity coffees. I'm more of an earthy coffee guy, but I do bring in some of the fruit dabbles into it. I source my beans from Brazil, Tanzania, Colombia, Costa Rica, Indonesia, Ethiopia is my latest one, which I'm very proud of. I'm excited to try out the new organic Yirgacheffe, which has been bringing out some blueberry notes, but it's really fun. It's a fun game because, unlike some industries, you know, I can take the goalposts and move them a little bit closer. So I can take a Brazilian, right, and blend that with, say, a Sumatra. So you might love the notes of a very smooth Brazilian and then the earthy notes of a Sumatra, and bring them together. Unlike a tomato. If you had a tomato, you'd have an heirloom and you'd have a cherry, and you can't really bring them together unless you're a fantastic chef and you bring in some other elements. So as a coffee roaster, I get to bring in an element that might be a little to the right and a little bit to the left, and make a little bit of a marriage happen. And that's why my Warrior 2, which is my light roast coffee, I'm very proud of. Very earthy, has a little bit of fig, a little bit of green tea. But then you combine that with like a single origin Ethiopian, where there's a little bit of light blueberry with some smooth, and so you can kind of incorporate all these tastes and create different coffees, which a lot of coffee industry, they're very proud of the single origin. Mm-hmm. I try to bring blends in because I like to bring in a little bit of the left and a little bit of the right and bring them to center and see if we can find a good marriage.
Sounds like Willy Wonka's laboratory.
I've been blending my coffee for years. I mean, I'll get the beans, and then, but now I'm going to try some of yours.
So let's talk about your different product lines.
Yeah. Well,
I'm impressed that I've never even heard anybody blending it on their own. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I have a burr grinder, and I'll take a certain percentage of this bean and a certain percentage of this. I only do two because I'm not that advanced, but, and then it's just, I'm a coffee snob. I hate to say it.
Well,
I love a good coffee.
Look, Park City, we expect the most out of our skiers and our alpiners, and so, you know, expect more from your coffee experience.
So talk to us about your lines.
Sure. My lines are, right now I have six different types of coffees. I have all skier, you know, I'm an avid skier, so, you know, my premise behind them is to kind of have a skier theme. My lightest roast is my Warrior 2. I have a medium roast that is my backcountry blend, which is Tanzania and Colombia. So two distinct tastes that kind of come together for your coffee drinker that's probably more of a pour over, you know, 3 cups a day in the morning type person, or an Americano. I have my my medium to dark, which is more like a medium, which is my Heli Drop. And that's a single origin Brazil Cerrado, which I think is just an absolutely clean, fantastic coffee. I'm thinking about incorporating just a little bit of my Ethiopian into that. And then I have my Balls Deep Espresso, which is just, you know, for that person that just, you know, kind of like my dad type of coffee drinker. It's dark, it's you know, you're by the campfire and you just want a bold coffee, so.
That's mine.
And where are you, what's your channels of distribution? Where can people find your coffees?
Right now, I'm starting slow. So I'm you know, measuring twice and cutting once in terms of how I'm going to implement my strategy into the Park City market. But right now, the market on Park City, the grocery store, Oliver and Tweed. I have Park City Gourmet, which is over by Kimball Junction. And then I do a home delivery service for people that just, you know, they want to have coffee that's, you know, a week from roast. And so those people have found me online, and I deliver Mondays and Fridays to their homes.
So they order online, and you will drop off a pound of coffee?
Correct, yeah. It's called a local subscription.
Okay.
And they'll just order and ask for local delivery. And so it cuts out on some of the costs that sometimes, you know, prices are pretty crazy right now for shipping and logistics. I do have customers across the country, but it's easier for me just to kind of hop in the car, fill up my car full of coffee and drop it off at people's houses and just, you know, thank them for their business. And I think that's, you know, between $3 and $4, where your typical, you know, $8 and $9 for some of the items that you're, you know, delivering across the country. So, yeah.
Yeah. And what's the range of pricing on the shelf at the market, for example? What would I say?
It depends if it's on an on sale item or not, but typically between $15 and $19, you know, a pound. And then some of my specialty coffees go as much as $23 a pound, which would obviously be my Ethiopia or my Costa Rica Jaguar honey. But they're very select, you know, coffee palettes. But I'm going to incorporate those into my other tastes as well. So
have you tried to find any kind of local restaurant or something to serve your coffees?
Absolutely. In fact, I was cold calling last week. My previous hobby was obviously going out and just, you know, talking to people. And so, yeah, I did stop by 3 or 4 different restaurants last week. And so I'm excited. I actually have begun the process of working with some high-end sports stores here just to have some, you know, an add-on
nice
item.
Idea, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, these people, they're going out and buying a $1,500 jacket. They might want, you know, an $18 bag of coffee. Who knows? So, but I'm excited to see where that goes. And in terms of the restaurant, high-end quality, definitely want to drop off some bags here in the next couple weeks. So
nice. So if people want to order or find out more information about Powder Hounds Coffee, how can they do that?
The best way would be just to go online, powderhoundscoffee.com, and order up a bag. And like I said, we you know, I stand by the coffee that we're roasting, and whatever experience that you like. We did on our online, we did put a little bit of a profile of how you prep your coffee in the morning. We only sell whole bean right now until there's a demand for ground coffee. But yeah, just look us up online, and yeah, I'm excited to take care of anybody's advanced palates.